This evening's Faith and Film lecture examines the question, why do comrades at war engage in battle? What motivates them? What binds them to one another? What is the proper way to motivate troops in a democracy? And how do we simultaneously celebrate wartime heroism while at the same time refraining from making war an end in itself? It is, I think, the movie Patton that allows us to address these questions. But before we study the movie that is at the centerpiece, that is the centerpiece of this lecture, let us first look at one of the most famous scenes in literature involving war and involving unity in war. And that is Shakespeare's Henry V, who before the Battle of Agincourt readies his men against superior numbers by telling them that on the anniversary of this battle, on St. Crispin's Day, each of them could hold a Passover Seder of sorts, where over a goblet of drink, they can recount their own feats, their own heroism. They can celebrate themselves. This is the famous St. Crispin's Day Agincourt speech. Let us watch Kenneth Branagh deliver the famous, the justly celebrated Shakespearean.
Old men forget, yet all shall be forgot, but he'll remember with advantages what feats he did that day. Then shall our names, familiar in their mouths as household words, Harry the King, Bedford and Exeter, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups freshly remembered. This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day!
Stirring words and an immortal phrase, we few, we happy few, we band of brothers. But is being part of a band of brothers what truly motivates this army, according to Henry's own words? Based on what he says, ultimately, what is the goal is not the opportunity to sacrifice for one another, but rather to hold a St. Crispin's Day celebration. Every year at Passover, Jews, over cups of wine, give gratitude to God for the redemption. But here, according to Henry's speech, the warrior of Agincourt will tell his son, not of the Almighty's outstretched arm, but rather of his own. Or as Kenneth Branagh says so well, then will he strip his sleeves and show his scars and say, these wounds I had on Crispin's Day. Shakespeare has Henry giving us an inverted Passover Seder, marked not by humility, but by glory. And here is what is so interesting. As I believe Shakespeare scholars note, in the end, when victory at Agincourt is achieved, Henry biblically reverts to celebrating the Almighty's arm. And he utterly reneges on his promise to celebrate the names of those who fought with him. He reads aloud the remarkably few Englishmen that fell in battle, and he says as follows: Edward, the Duke of York, the Earl of Suffolk, Sir Richard Ketley, Davy Gam, Esquire. And then he adds, none else of name, and all other men but 25. O God, thy arm was here, and not to us but to thy arm alone ascribe we all. In other words, those heroic fallen at Agincourt, who were not noble, who were of no name, were not even to be mourned, much less remembered. So much in retrospect for Henry V's band of brothers. Shakespeare seems to realize that actually something was spiritually amiss with the original St. Crispin's Day speech, that while it worked to motivate the soldiers, its own themes were less than ideal. As scholars further point out, this reveals that Shakespeare is not at all certain of the fact that Henry's war in France was a just one. As the first act reveals, Henry has been largely conned to believe that he is the rightful ruler of France by the Archbishop of Canterbury in order to take the king's focus away from taxing the money of the churches. In the play, on behalf of the at Agincourt, Henry makes little mention even of England, except to say that those across the channel would regret not fighting for him. It is affiliation with royalty, honor, glory, almost idolization of the king that drives the troops. Henry V is seen today by many as an unproblematic patriotic play, but this is largely because of its most famous performance. Laurence Olivier's TV portrayal of the Shakespearean king in 1944 in the midst of World War II. Of course, Britain's battle against the Nazis was an undeniably just cause. But in the play, at least at Agincourt, the soldiers are asked to fight for Henry and for the glory that they will achieve because their names will forever be known with his. Then shall their names familiar in their mouths as household words. Names that ultimately are not known. Names that are ultimately forgotten. The phrase band of brothers is an apt one to apply to an army in a democracy. But this is not the army that Henry leads. And this in turn brings us to another famous speech. A speech which actually truly took place. A speech that was also made famous in film. Indeed, it is one of the most well-known openings to a movie in the history of cinema. The film Patton features George C. Scott as the World War II general, and it begins with him striding onto a stage in front of a massive American flag and delivering a speech to prepare his troops for war. The words that Patton speaks at the start of the movie were not made up. They were taken from an actual series of films, from an actual series of remarks that Patton delivered to the Third Army before it was deployed. Now, for all the flaws that Patton had, and he had flaws, and the film reveals some of them, nevertheless, there are deep lessons to be learned from Patton and from the film that bears his name about what warrior teamwork should actually be in a free nation. Let's begin with a bit of the speech where Patton describes what he calls the American love of war. And then he turns to the importance of teamwork. Let's see this.
Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love the sting of battle. When you were kids, you all admired the champion marble shooter, the fastest runner, big league ball players, the toughest boxers. Americans love a winner and will not tolerate a loser. Americans play to win all the time. I wouldn't give a hoot in hell for a man who lost and laughed. That's why Americans have never lost and will never lose a war. Because the very thought of losing is hateful to Americans. Now, an army is a team. It lives, eats, sleeps, fights as a team. This individuality stuff is a bunch of crap.
An army is a team. It lives, eats, sleeps, and fights as a team. Patton actually said these words to the Third Army. Here's a bit more of what he said, which is not in the film. He said, "All the real heroes are not storybook combat fighters. Every single man in the army plays a vital role, so don't ever let up. Don't ever think your job is unimportant. What if every truck driver decided he didn't like the whine of the shells and turned yellow and jumped headlong into a ditch? Where in the heck would we be then? No, thank God, Americans don't say that. Every man does his job. Every man is important. The ordnance men are needed to supply the guns. The quartermaster is needed to bring up the food and clothes for us because where we are going, there isn't a heck of a lot to steal. Every last darn man in the mess hall, even the one who boils the water to keep us from getting sick, has a job to do. One of the bravest men I saw," Patton continued, "in the African campaign was on a telegraph pole in the midst of furious fire while we were moving toward Tunis. I stopped and asked him what the heck he was doing up there. He answered, fixing the wire, sir. Isn't it a little unhealthy up there right now, I asked. Yes, sir, but this gosh darn wire has got to be fixed. I asked, don't these planes strafing the road bother you? And he answered, no, sir, but you sure as heck do. Now Patton says, there was a real soldier, a real man. A man who devoted all he had to his duty, no matter how great the odds, no matter how seemingly insignificant his duty appeared at the time. These were Patton's own words, though I cleaned up the parts of the speech a little bit. That is how he talked. This is a true speech about creating a band of brothers. And after Patton created that band of brothers, then he spoke very frankly about the violence and war, utilizing phrases that were part of his inimitable style. Let's watch a little bit more of the speech.
Now we have the finest food and equipment, the best spirit, and the best men in the world. You know, my God, I actually pity those poor bastards we're going up against. By God, I do. We're not just going to shoot the bastards. We're going to cut out their living guts and use them to grease the treads of our tanks. We're going to murder those lousy Hun bastards by the bushel. Now, some of you boys, I know, are wondering whether or not you'll chicken out under fire. Don't worry about it. I can assure you that you will all do your duty. The Nazis are the enemy. Wade into them. Spill their blood. Shoot them in the belly. When you put your hand into a bunch of goo that a moment before was your best friend's face, you'll know what to do. Now, there's another thing I want you to remember. I don't want to get any messages saying that we are holding our position. We're not holding anything. Let the Hun do that. We are advancing constantly, and we're not interested in holding on to anything except the enemy.
This is what Patton said in his original speech. Then there's one thing you men will be able to say when this war is over and you get back home. 30 years from now, when you're sitting by your fireside with your grandson on your knee and he asks, what did you do in the great World War II? You won't have to cough and say, well, your granddaddy shoveled dung in Louisiana. No, sir, you can look him straight in the eye and say, son, your granddaddy rode with the great Third Army and that son of a gosh darned SOB named George Patton. That's what he said, with a little bit of editing by me. And he concluded, all right, you sobs, you know how I feel. I'll be proud to lead you wonderful guys in battle anytime, anywhere. That's all. So ladies and gentlemen, if we watch Kenneth Branagh and George C. Scott, Henry V, and Patton, to watch the two speeches side by side is to see how seemingly unsophisticated and vulgar Patton's is in comparison to Henry's. But if Henry V and Shakespeare gives us a royal battle speech, Patton gives us a truly democratic one. And that is what is great about his legacy. For as the film Patton shows, and as the historian Victor Davis Hanson emphasizes in his great work, The Soul of Battle, the Third Army, through Patton's leadership, became a single mind that worked together. It achieved, at times, what was seemingly impossible to other commanders, to travel across enormous distances in freezing cold in a short period of time, in order to relieve the soldiers at Bastion during the Battle of the Bulge. This scene is also one of the most striking ones in the film. The preparation to relieve Bastion.
We've identified four German armies, the 7th, 5th Panzer, 6th SS Panzer, and the 15th. They've hit us with 26 divisions. They overran two regiments of the 106th Division, and 7,500 of our men were forced to surrender. Our immediate concern is that von Rundstedt has the 101st Airborne trapped here at Bastogne.
Bastogne, by the way, is the key to this entire area. If we can hold it, we can break up the entire German offensive. If they take it, we're in serious trouble. Ike wants to know if anybody can get up there and relieve the 101st before they're torn to pieces.
I'm afraid there's nothing that Field Marshal Montgomery can do. At any rate, not for some weeks.
What about you, George?
I can attack with 3 divisions in 48 hours.
Well, I'd give myself some leeway if I were you.
Ike wants a realistic estimate, George. You're in the middle of a fight now, and it's over 100 miles to Bastogne.
My staff's already working out the details.
Well, frankly, I don't see how it's possible. Not in this kind of weather.
I should have thought you'd want to fall back and regroup.
Not me, Freddy. I don't like to pay for the same real estate twice.
But what about your men? You can't pull them out of the line and cart them off 100 miles and then expect them to attack without rest.
I train these men, Arthur. They'll do what I tell them to do.
Perhaps we hadn't realized that you were quite so popular with your troops, General.
I'm not. They'll do it because they're good soldiers. And because they realize, as I do, that we can still lose this war.
And march to Bastogne they did, over 100 miles. And Patton, in a true reification of what it means to be part of a band of brothers, becomes one of them. He is a member of the Third Army, and yet simultaneously as leader, so proud of them. This, too, is depicted in the film.
This is where it pays off. The training and the discipline. No other outfit in the world. Pull out of a winter battle, move 100 miles, go into a major attack with no rest, no sleep, no hot food. God, I'm proud of these men.
This scene brings to life an operation that Victor Davis Hanson has argued is one of the great moments in the battle on behalf of freedom and democracy. And it bears mentioning that even as Patton's own expressed feelings about the Jews were certainly not always very positive, Patton did also join his democratic approach to battle with a biblical one, reminding his soldiers that their teamwork and their valor had to go hand in hand with reliance on the grace of God. My favorite scene in the movie takes place during the Battle of the Bulge, when better weather was required by the Allied forces, and Patton calls over a chaplain. Let's watch the scene.
You want to see me, General?
Oh, yes, Chaplain. I'm sick and tired of Third Army having to fight the Germans with supreme command, no gasoline, and now this ungodly weather. I want a prayer, a weather prayer.
A weather prayer, sir?
Yes, let's see if you can't get God working with us in this thing.
It's going to take a pretty thick rug for that kind of praying.
I don't care if it takes a flying carpet.
No, I don't know how this is going to be received, General. Praying for good weather so we can kill our fellow man.
Well, I can assure you, sir, because of my intimate relations with the Almighty, if you write a good prayer, we'll have good weather. I expect that prayer within an hour.
Yes, sir.
almighty and most merciful Father, we humbly beseech thee, of thy great goodness, to restrain this immoderate weather with which we've had to contend. Grant us fair weather for battle. Graciously hearken to us as soldiers who call upon thee, that armed with thy power, we may advance from victory to victory and crush the oppression and wickedness of our enemies, and establish thy justice among men and nations. Amen.
Fair weather did come after the prayer was said. Now, what's interesting is that in contrast to the way the story is depicted in the film, according to the chaplain involved in the story, he personally actually had no hesitation about composing the prayer. Monsignor James H. O'Neill describes how actually, after he wrote it for Patton, the general ordered that 250,000 copies of it should be printed up on cards, and that these cards should be distributed to the troops. You could see here on the screen what this prayer card looked like. In other words, Patton believed that the army was a team and that it not only fought as a team, it prayed as a team. The Third Army's effort was critical, but the assistance of the Almighty was needed as well. Monsignor O'Neill further reports that Patton said to him the following: "Chaplain, I am a strong believer in prayer. There are three ways that men get what they want: by planning, by working, and by praying. Any great military operation takes careful planning or thinking. Then you must have well-trained troops to carry it out. That's working. But between the plan and the operation, there is always an unknown. That unknown spells defeat or victory, success or failure. It is a reaction of the actors to the ordeal when it actually comes. Some people call that getting the breaks. I," Patton said, "I call it God. God has his part or margin in everything. That's where prayer comes in. Up to now in the Third Army, God has been very good to us. We have never retreated. We have suffered no defeats, no famine, no epidemics. This is because a lot of people back home are praying for us. We were lucky in Africa and Sicily and in Italy, simply because people prayed. But we have to pray for ourselves too. A good soldier is not made merely by making him think and work. There is something in every soldier that goes deeper than thinking or working. It's his guts. It is something that he has built in there. It is a world of truth and power that is higher than himself. Great living is not all output of thought and work. A man has to have intake as well. I don't know what you call it, but I call it religion, prayer, or God." So when Patton said an army is a team, he meant that this was true when it came to valor, when it came to bravery, when it came to working on behalf of one another and sacrificing for one another, but it also translated into collective reliance on and prayer to God. As I was researching the Patton prayer, I came upon something utterly fascinating, which I'd love to share with you. And that's the image that you can see on the screen right now. This is the very same Patton prayer card, but with a few words written on it in cursive. I found it on a website dedicated to the 134th Infantry Regiment. And there it shares a copy of the prayer card sent home by a soldier to his parents. The soldier was a Jew by the name of Stanley Spiler, serving in the 2nd Battalion. Now, this card, by the way, had a Christmas message from Patton on the other side. But this young Jewish man wrote on the Patton prayer card in Yiddish. It's Yiddish cursive. And he explains the weather miracle to his folks back home. I have to say that his Yiddish is not very good, which makes it all the more appealing. If you can read Yiddish, you'll see on the second line, he wrote, "Und der Regen hat gestoppt," which means the rain stopped, but that's not actually very good Yiddish at all. And then wonderfully, the final part, also in a Yinglish of sorts, can be translated as, "From your son Stanley, who is part of the Third Army." What Stanley is doing here is he is joining this democratic moment and this religious moment, and he's sharing with his parents that he was part of this providential and military event. And yet, in the midst of Patton's democratic speeches and in the midst of his inspiring remarks about faith, we do notice, especially in the film, that Patton seems at times a bit too excited about war. At the heart of the film is the point that Patton is only truly happy when he's in the midst of battle. The death and the violence of war is for Patton a source, and I think this is not an exaggeration, a source of delight. In one moving scene, as Patton ponders the German retreat, he remembers an earlier retreat, that of Napoleon, and then he is suddenly honest about himself. It is moving because it is also very troubling. Let's see what Patton says.
You know how I'm sure they're finished out there? The carts. They're using carts to move their wounded and their supplies. The carts came to me in my dream. They kept buzzing around in my head. I couldn't figure it out. And I remembered. A nightmare in the snow, the endless, agonizing retreat from Moscow. How cold it was. They took the wounded and what was left of the supplies and threw them in the carts. Napoleon was finished. Not any color left, not even the red of blood. Only the snow. Look at this cart. I love it. God help me, I do love it so. I love it more than my life.
In contrast, for the Tanakh, for the Bible, war is often necessary, but we are not called to love it. And this point was made in a speech about peace by someone who was seen by the world as a man of war. When receiving the Nobel Peace Prize, Menachem Begin made the point that it was the Jews that bestowed the very notion of peace to the world. As he said, the ancient Jewish people gave the world a vision of eternal peace, of universal disarmament, of abolishing the teaching and learning of war. Two prophets, Yeshayahu ben Amoz and Micha HaMorashti, that's Isaiah and Micah, having foreseen the spiritual unity of man under God with his word coming forth from Jerusalem, gave the nations of the world the following vision expressed in identical terms, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. So Begin said, but after he made this point, he also reminded the audience implicitly of the fact that he, the man who was there to celebrate peace, had had his own family destroyed, his father and mother murdered, and that the world had not stopped it. And that this had taught him that evil often had to be fought and destroyed before peace was possible. And we, therefore, Begin said that we have to understand when war is an obligation, even as it is never something that is to be seen as a source of joy. And so he wrote, he said, but in my generation, ladies and gentlemen, there was a time indescribable. 6 million Jews, men, women, and children, a number larger than many a nation in Europe, were dragged to a wanton death and slaughtered methodically in the heart of the civilized continent. Other than a few famous and unforgettable exceptions, they were left alone to face the destroyer. At such a time, unheard of since the first generation, the hour struck to rise and fight for the dignity of man, for survival, for liberty, for every value of the human image of man has been endowed with by his Creator. For every known inalienable right he stands for and lives for, indeed, Begin added, there are days when to fight for a cause so absolutely just is the highest human command. And then he added, only in honoring that command comes the regeneration of the concept of peace. Let it, however, be declared and known, stressed and noted, that fighters for freedom hate war. It is a striking contrast to the scene from Patton. God help me, I love it so, says the general. Fighters for freedom, says Begin, hate war. War for Judaism is at times profoundly necessary, but it is never something beloved. And the Jewish view of war and peace, as articulated by Begin, is actually best embodied by the temple in Jerusalem. This extraordinary edifice was the dream of King David. Building it was the summit of his hopes, but this was denied by God, according to the Bible, because, as David himself says in Chronicles, he was a man of war. This does not mean that David's battles were wrong. We celebrate his heroism on behalf of Israel. But David had to die before the temple was built because had David concluded his career by building what would inevitably have been seen as a monument to his might, had Israel's greatest warrior built a temple, then, as I have written and argued, the Israelites would have been tempted to see David's lifetime endeavors of war as achievements to glorify and events to celebrate on a par with Israel's worship of the divine. And that in turn would mean that Judea would become Rome. God's temple in Jerusalem would be built by David's son Solomon, whose name means peace. And this clarifies the ultimate purpose of all of David's efforts, that the purpose of war is to defeat evil. And in the end, Judaism's ultimate aspiration is that all nations will come to the mountain of God and beat their swords into plowshares, and the word of the Lord will pour forth from Jerusalem. The Bible marks military heroism, and it stresses that violence is at times profoundly necessary. But precisely for this reason, the Bible never asks us to say what Patton says. I love it so. Never does David, warrior of Israel, say such a thing. And the point is that a nation that loves war above all else cannot survive the loss of its power. But there is a people that is very ancient, a people that has won wars and that has lost wars, and that has still endured. And while the film Patton is not about the Jewish people, watching this film does ask us to ponder why the Jewish people still exist. Let me conclude by explaining what I mean. Toward the beginning of the movie, Patton is depicted driving with another general, Omar Bradley, in the North African desert when he suddenly spies the site of ancient Carthage. The city of Carthage, built on the northern tip of what is now Tunisia, sat at the center of an empire. Carthage was known for its military prowess. It waged several wars against Rome, known as the Punic Wars. As Victor Davis Hanson points out in his new book, which devotes a chapter to Carthage, the last Punic War featured a force by Rome that, as he puts it, was likely larger than the American contingent that landed on D-Day. Carthage ultimately fell to Rome. Almost all its residents were massacred. The city was razed to the ground. And as Hansen describes, a century later, there were no Carthaginians. In this movie, Patton sees the site and he insists that they pull over. And because he was a believer in reincarnation, he actually felt that he had been at every major battle in world history, including the Third Punic War. Let's watch the scene.
Hold it. Turn right here.
Sir, the battlefield is straight ahead.
Please don't argue with me, Sergeant. I can smell a battlefield.
He was out here just yesterday, George.
It's over there. Turn right, damn it.
Was here. The battlefield was here. The Carthaginians defending the city were attacked by three Roman legions. The Carthaginians were proud and brave, but they couldn't hold. They were massacred. Arab women stripped them of their tunics and their swords and lances. The soldiers lay naked in the sun. 2,000 years ago. I was here. You don't believe me, do you, Brad? You know what the poet said. Through the travail of ages, amidst the pomp and toils of war, have I fought and strove and perished countless times upon the star. As if through a glass and darkly, the age-old strife I see, where I fought in many guises, many names, but always me. You know who the poet was? Me.
Patton did actually write that poem about being at every battle. The point of the scene at Carthage is to stress the strangeness of a man who personally identifies with a war that took place so many centuries ago. But the truth is, to Jews, this scene is anything but odd, because we remember moments that took place in the ancient past. And to remember those moments does not require a belief in reincarnation. Rather, one must merely have what Rabbi Joseph Soloveitcher called a unitive time consciousness, meaning an emotional bond to the past. But what we as Jews remember and relive and revisit is not only the battles, but also the salvations, the highs and the lows. And we personally identify with the spiritual heroes as well as the military heroes in our history. And we remember above all Jerusalem and its temple, a temple that reminded us that there is something higher than war itself. Let me just give you one example. In July of 1977, Menachem Begin, the newly elected Prime Minister of Israel, arrived in America, and he was interviewed on Meet the Press on the ninth day of the Jewish month of Av, when we mourn the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. Begin, on the TV show, was immediately asked about his meeting with President Carter, but Begin said, "With your permission, before I answer this very important question, I would like to say a few words about the day we now meet, because of its universal importance. Today, in accordance with our calendar, it is the ninth of the month of Av. It is the day when, 1,907 years ago, the Roman legions, the 5th and the 12th, launched their ultimate onslaught on the Temple Mountain, set this temple ablaze, and destroyed Jerusalem, subjugating our people and conquering our land. Historically, this is the beginning of all the suffering of our people, dispersed, humiliated, and ultimately now a generation physically destroyed. We remember that day, and now have the responsibility to make sure that never again will our independence be destroyed." Begin said this on Meet the Press, and the journalist interviewing him probably had no idea what he was talking about. And he probably looked at Begin the way in the scene we see the other general, General Omar Bradley, looking at Patton thinking, what is this guy, crazy? Begin was remembering the destruction of a city that was older than Carthage and that was destroyed two centuries after Carthage fell by the very same empire, the Roman Empire. And Begin was communicating that the memory of this city in ancient times guided his decisions now in the present. He remembered the military defeat, he remembered the destruction of Jerusalem, but he also remembered the temple that stood at the apex of the city. The comparison between Patton and Begin highlights the differences. Carthage is gone. Patton, remembering the Third Punic War, was remembering it as an American. But Begin was remembering the destruction of Jerusalem while leading in a rebuilt Jerusalem. And the lesson is that while war is often essential for a people's endurance, only a people that sees war as a means rather than an end, only a people that can say like Begin that war is essential for the defeat of evil and thereby the bringing of peace, but war is not to be glorified as an end in itself, only a people that sees its relationship with God and his moral matrix and his covenant as the highest goal, only such a people can endure the travails of military history. And thus, the Patton scene at Carthage teaches us something profound about a people and war. The reason why Victor Davis Hanson discusses Carthage in his new book, titled The End of Everything, is because the book is about civilizations that suddenly disappear. Hanson argues that Once one's capital is destroyed, that nation usually ceases to exist. But Jerusalem was such a city. And like Carthage, it was destroyed with the Romans creating a name for the region in an attempt to destroy any Jewish claim to Judea. The name the Romans came up with to erase the Jewish history of the land was Palestine. What happened to Carthage and the Carthaginians should have occurred to Judea and the Jews as well. But it didn't. It didn't. Hansen's book about Carthage and other such peoples called The End of Everything should have really been called The End of Almost Everything. Because one people did not disappear. A people that prized its covenant above power, above war, above everything else, while not dismissing the importance of power and war. This lesson that there is something higher than war, even as we honor those that fought in wars on behalf of supreme virtues, lies at the heart of the biblical vision and at the heart of another famous wartime speech, that of Lincoln at Gettysburg, who celebrated the sacrifice of those Union soldiers that died, and who then emphasized that this war was also not an end in itself. Rather, it obligated a renewal of the American covenant, so that the soldiers who fell did not die in vain. To watch Patton is therefore to be inspired and to ponder how democratic kinship and faith in God is necessary for a flourishing society that is willing to defend itself. But the film also warns us not to see war as the ultimate aspiration and not to merely revel in the glory in battle, as Henry suggests we ought to do in his St. Christmas Day speech. In the final scene of the movie Patton, with the general relieved by Eisenhower, we hear him make the following reflection.
For over 1,000 years, Roman conquerors returning from the wars enjoyed the honor of a triumph, a tumultuous parade. In the procession came trumpeters and musicians and strange animals from the conquered territories, together with carts laden with treasure and captured armaments. The conqueror rode in a triumphal chariot, the dazed prisoners walking in chains before him. Sometimes his children, robed in white, stood with him in the chariot or rode the trace horses. A slave stood behind the conqueror, holding a golden crown and whispering in his ear a warning that all glory is fleeting.
War is at times profoundly important, and the valor of soldiers obligates us with remembrance and reverence. But this film also reminds us, as Americans, and for me, also as a Jew, that a people must stress that there is something higher than military glory if it wishes to ensure that it will not soon perish from the earth. Thank you very much.